Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You on this December 27th day of 2015. I'm Larry Kay, a recovered compulsive overeater from Chicago, and I want to let you know that the share ID for Friday, December 25th, is 8295. That's 8295, the share ID for Friday. Well, Vision for You welcomes this morning Kathleen W. She's going to be from Arizona. She's going to be sharing, what is this but a miracle of healing? And, you know, she's going to be weaving chapter four through her own personal story. You know, chapter four, you know, talks about how it works. And boy, oh boy, you know, this program of action that we find in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous really gets us to a point where we can begin to apply these principles and work these steps. And it tells us just exactly how the heck this works. And so I know that for me, you know, navigating through this this big book, the first 164 pages, which is the practical program of action, you know, was a little bit treacherous. But we find that it wasn't as difficult as we made it out to be, that there were some very specific instructions that we would find out precisely what our problem was. Very early in the big book, it would tell us what our problem was. We would then, you know, begin to navigate and find out what the solution to that problem was. And then we would be able to have some specific instructions that the big book gives us on how to bring that solution to light. And, you know, bringing the solution to light brings us into alignment with a higher power of our own understanding. And the big book lays out these principles in the 12 steps that we study each morning on A Vision for You. So now what I'd like to do is I'd like to turn it over to Kathleen W. from Arizona. Kathleen, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Are you there, Kathleen?
Yes, my pleasure. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you wonderfully. You take it away.
Great. I wanted to thank you, Larry, for your service and everyone who has always helped out on this meeting. It has just made such a difference in my life to study the big book like we do every morning. I'm very grateful. And my name is Kathleen W., and I'm 51, and I live in Phoenix, Arizona. And I want to share my experience, strength, and hope, and how it relates to Chapter 4 in the big book. And I love the line on page 57, the second paragraph, where it says, "What is this but a miracle of healing?" Because I can identify that with my life experience and where I was and where I am today. And on page 44, in the middle of the paragraph, it says, "If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, in our case compulsive overeating, you have little control over how much you take, you are probably alcoholic or compulsive overeater, in our case. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer." I can identify with that paragraph. Ever since I was a little girl, I knew there was a God carrying me through my life. My higher power is God. But I trusted and relied on him. I could never trust and rely on him for my eating disorder. I knew there was a God, but I never asked him for help with my eating disorder. And when they wrote this book, they wanted everyone to have this miracle of recovery. So no matter what your higher power is, everyone has access to this wonderful solution. On the bottom of page 46, it says, "The realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men." So I grew up as the fourth and youngest child. I've lived in Phoenix since I was four. My dad got a job transfer. My dad was, just to give you some background, my dad was a raging alcoholic. And he was emotionally unavailable. Just to give you an example, my mom would have a lot of dinner parties, and she would spend a lot of time really preparing to have all these people over and getting food ready all day. And then my dad would be drinking, and then he would start an argument with one of the guests, and then they would get angry and everyone would leave, and then my parents would fight. And so that went on a lot as a child. And then I have two older sisters. One is bipolar and alcoholic, and then I had a brother. I have two sisters. One's 15 months older than me. The other one's 4 years older than me. And then I had a brother who was 6 years older than me. And my parents had a lot of problems with him. And he was later diagnosed with schizophrenia. And he ended up committing suicide. It'll be 4 years ago on St. Patrick's Day. And I do think that he was a compulsive eater just like me. He struggled with his mental illness when he was younger, and he would medicate on LSD and other drugs. And my dad and my brother had violent fights. They would get into physical fights. There was blood splattered on the wall. My brother would pull a gun on him. There was police in our house almost every night. And I was sent to my room, and I remember just screaming. And I was probably about maybe eight, and I would scream, and I was just, that's when my 100 forms of fear started. That became one of my coping mechanisms. I was full of fear, and it carried through until my adulthood. And so I just was a very terrified and frightened little girl. And I would go to school the next day, and I would feel different from everyone. And I felt different from everyone. That stayed with me, fear and feeling different from everyone, like I didn't fit in. And my mom would buy Twinkies and Ding Dongs for quote-unquote special occasions, and she would hide them in the kitchen drawer. And then my sister was not a compulsive overeater, but we would find them. And I remember I was probably about eight, and I would go in the backyard, and I would sit and eat the ding-dong in the orange tree. And so that's when my eating in isolation began. And then there was a big family that lived across the street, and I used to go over there and play a lot. And there was a little girl that was a year younger than me, and we played a lot, and they had a lot of food. And I would always say, Teresa, what do you guys have to eat? And my real motivation was to eat while I was at her house. And then, I mean, I remember sitting in her avocado green booth in the kitchen and just scooping these weird concoctions, scooping potato chips with ice cream and, you know, just some really strange food behaviors. And I learned to escape my scary feelings of fear with the food, and it numbed the pain, and it was how I dealt with my fear as a child. And I grew up in a traditional church, and the only place I ever felt safe was when I was in church standing next to my mom, and she was singing, and I would have just a peace in my heart. And God was there with me, and he planted peace in my heart, but this was the only peace I ever felt at that time. And on page 55, on the second paragraph, it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And that memory has stayed with me. And looking back, I can see that God was even with me back then, but I still felt all alone. And as the years went by, my 100 forms of fear kept growing, and I still used food as comfort. And then when I look back on my senior high school graduation picture, my face was really puffy from binging. And then I went on a senior high school trip, and I was getting ready to graduate, and I just binged a lot because, once again, I had my 100 forms of fear. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? You know, it was very fearful to graduate from high school. I had no coping skills. And I went on the senior trip to Disneyland, and I remember I specifically bought this dress that was free-flowing because when I would binge, I would look pregnant and my stomach would just get so extended and I couldn't have anything binding around my stomach because it was so uncomfortable. And I remember on that senior trip, I was wearing, I bought a pair of jeans and they were just so tight that I refused to get a bigger size and they were just so uncomfortable. And when I look back on those pictures, you know, that should have been a fun time for me, but it was a painful time. You know, I was not a happy time because I was binging. And then when I was 19, I worked at a hospital and I transported patients to and from x-ray. And I had this purple jumpsuit outfit. And I wore it because it had, once again, an extendable waistband. And I didn't realize how inappropriately short it was. And I wore it because I was limited as to what fit. And then I was mortified when my boss paged me at work and I called him back to ask what he needed. And he said that one of the nurses complained about how short my outfit was and that it was inappropriate and never wear it again. And I was mortified. And I remember, I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty certain I binged over that. And then I took diet pills. And one time, when I was same job working at that hospital, I took some diet pills and I had a really bad reaction and I could hear my heartbeat in my head. I felt like I was going to have a heart attack. And I had some coworkers that worked in ER and they gave me a bottle of Epicac. And I drank the whole thing and I became violently ill and I threw up uncontrollably. And when I was done, I felt like I got hit by a car. And these are the kinds of things that I would do, you know, to try to deal with my binging. It was just insane. And then when I was 19, a lot of my darkest time of my eating disorder was when I was around 19, early 20s. And I don't remember if I had quit my job or what, but I was laid in bed a lot. I would binge and sleep and binge and sleep. And I did steal a bunch of the hospital greens from the hospital I was working at because they had the drawstring waistband and it's the only thing I really could wear. And I would isolate and shut the blinds. And I would just, the only sunshine I saw during this period was when I would go to the grocery store to get my binge food. And then I would just come home and then I also had laxatives. And I don't know if anyone on the line has ever used laxatives, but I'm not even going to go into the details, but you know what I'm talking about. And then I wouldn't shower for like days on end. My hair was really greasy. My face was very bloated. And I felt like I didn't even deserve a shower. In the bathroom we had, on the one wall, it was all a mirror, and I wouldn't turn the light on because I was disgusted with myself. I didn't want to see my face, and then one time, it's like I would binge and sleep and binge and sleep and binge and sleep, and it was just, I was only 19, and it was, you know, I was wasting my life away, you know, but I can't forget where I came from and what it was truly like for me, and one time, my sister came over and I was just, you know, I was binging in my green scrubs and I talked to her through the comforter. I wouldn't get out from under the comforter because I didn't want her to see my face. And she's like, opened the blinds and stuff. And she's like, what's wrong with you? And I said, I just lied and I just told her I wasn't feeling well. And I wanted her to hurry up and leave so I could just be alone in my misery. And cloudy days were always an excuse to binge and sleep all day. and then I told my mom that I wanted to go to a therapist for my anxiety, but I actually wanted to stop to find out why I couldn't stop binging. And the therapist I went to, he told me, just stop eating. And as you know, that doesn't work for us. And so I ended up in an outpatient eating disorder clinic, and I was in there with, I don't remember if it was a 12-step based program. I think I was in my early 20s by then. And I was, everyone else was either addicted to drugs or alcohol. And so I binged, and it was outpatient. I binged in the car there, and I binged on, in the car on the way home. And it really did not help me. And then I went to aftercare, and my mentor told me about OA, and he was my Ebby. And so I started, that's when I first started going to OA, and I spent years in and out of OA, and it never really stuck. And I never studied the doctor's opinion. I never knew what was wrong with me until I was 49 years old. So you can, I've wasted so many years in with this disease. And so, you know, and that's really what has made the difference for me, is just studying the big book like we, you know, 2 years ago, finally, like we do in our meetings. And so then I thought, well, if I'm going to give up my binge foods, then I might as well drink alcohol. So I became a binge drinker. And when I, you know, I would drink a ton of alcohol and get a really fast buzz very quickly. And I didn't realize that, you know, alcohol has sugar in it. And every time I drank alcohol, it would trigger the phenomenon of craving, as we learned in the doctor's opinion. And then after I would drink alcohol, then I would crave my binge foods. So not only was I binge drinking, but then I would binge on my food. And you can imagine what it felt like the next morning to not only have an alcohol hangover, but a food hangover. It was absolute misery. And I remember I couldn't stand being in my own skin. My skin crawled. I could smell and feel the toxins coming out of my body. I'm sure a lot of you can identify with what I'm talking about when we have a food hangover. And I never felt loved as a child. So I would try to find my identity in men, and I would find these emotionally unavailable men just like my dad. And then when it didn't work out and they rejected me, I would take a nosedive into the food and start binging again. And I would isolate and shut myself off from the world. And then I would lose weight and restrict while I was dating someone. And then when they discarded me, I would isolate again and start binging and gain my weight back. It was just an insane way to live. And I did this over and over and over for years. And I was in and out of a relapse for many years. And then when I was 25, I let my brother live with me, and he kept getting fired from his jobs because of his untreated mental illness, and I felt sorry for him. And one time he got mad at me, and he punched me in the eye. So I called the police, and he got arrested, and my dad bailed him out. And I hated my brother for years after that and was extremely resentful towards my dad for paying money to bail him out after he beat me up. And I didn't talk to my brother for years. He got married and divorced, and I never met his wife. And then I dated a noncommittal boyfriend for 6 years. And I told him, I said, I have a brother. You'll never meet him. And he never did. And then my parents got divorced after 29 years. My mom divorced my dad. And my dad looked to me and my sister for help and would call us all the time. I loved my dad, but I hated him for not being there for me as a child. I was resentful towards him because I felt like he was never there for me, and now he wanted me to be there for him. And I had so much anger and resentment inside of me, both towards my brother and my dad. And I did go to therapy for 2 years when I was 36 to deal with my dad issues. And, of course, my therapist discovered I was attracting emotionally unavailable men just like my dad. And I worked with her for 2 years. And I'm grateful I did. And it helped me tremendously. And then in 2002, my dad fell and broke his hip. And he ended up dying of pneumonia a month later. And I had tremendous healing in my dad's death. And looking back, I can see where God was carrying me the entire time. And he orchestrated everything. My dad was sober the last month of his life in a nursing home, and I got to see the true man that God created him to be. I sat on his bed in the nursing home 2 days before he died, and we talked and we both cried, and I told him that I felt like he was never there for me as a little girl, He looked me right in the eyes and told me that as his dad, he did the best he could. And for the first time in my life, I respected my dad, and I could see where he was coming from. All my resentments towards my dad were gone, and I felt complete love and compassion towards him. I ended up being with him when he took his last breath, and it was the most beautiful thing I've ever experienced next to my daughter being born. God carried me through the entire thing, and I knew there was a God, but I never trusted him with my eating disorder or asked him for help. And I knew as long as my dad was alive and until I worked through some things, it would be very difficult for me to have a healthy relationship. And then I met my husband 4.5 months after my dad died. I was still resentful towards my brother and still had not talked to him for 10 years. And my husband is a normie and doesn't have any addictions. So this was all new to him when he met me. And I remember one time when we were dating, he spent a lot of time at my house just helping me, you know, fix up my house and stuff like that. And one time, and I felt really insecure about telling him that I was in OA. And because I had a lot of shame about it, and I had gone to an OA meeting, and but of course, you know, I wasn't studying the Big Book. Excuse me. And so I came home, and he was like, "Where were you?" And I said, I was like, "Oh, okay, I get it. I need to be honest with him and tell him that I have an eating disorder." And so I told him, and I was just ready for him to say, "You have too much baggage. You know, I can't deal with this, and I'm out of here." And I even told him that. I said, if this is too much for you, you can break up with me, you know." And and that was not the case at all. He loved me, and he supported me, and he said, "You know, I don't know anything about eating disorders, but I want to try to understand, and I'm going to support you." And so it was just a beautiful thing. And he also encouraged me to heal my relationship with my brother. And I truly believe that that God works through my husband and my daughter to heal my relationship with my brother, because I had venom coming out of my mouth. I was just so resentful and angry. And then I got married for the first time when I was 39, and I had my one and only child when I was 41. She's going to be 10 next month. And just to go back a little bit, when I was 33, I just felt like I was, you know, I just wasn't worthy to ever marry anyone, and certainly I would never have kids. I had thought, you know, this is my lot in life. You know, I just have too much baggage. No one's going to love me. I'll never get married, and I certainly won't have kids. And I have a history of just having really bad cramps every month. And I remember I went to my doctor, and I told him, I said, I was 33, and I said, "I want to have a hysterectomy." And I said, "You know, I don't plan on having kids, and I just don't want to go through this every month." And he told me, he said, "Well, I can't do it. You're very healthy. You just are one of the unfortunates that has excruciating cramps every month, and your insurance won't pay for it." So I felt like my plan, that plan of mine, God slammed the door on it, because his plan was that I was going to get married when I was 39 and have my first and only child when I was 41. It's very clear to me now what was going on. And one thing about my life that really, really relates to chapter 4 is when I look in the rearview mirror, you know, this has been the hardest part for me, step 2, to really trust and rely on a power greater than myself, because my higher power, which is God, is invisible. But when I go through my life and I look in the rearview mirror, I can see where God's hand was in it, and And that's how I see my God working in my life. And so let me see. So then my, as I mentioned, God worked through my husband and my daughter to heal my relationship with my brother. And my brother, I mean, my husband, I keep getting everyone mixed up. My husband really encouraged me to heal my relationship with my brother. And next thing you know, I was, my brother was at the Arizona State Hospital. He was in solitary confinement for assaulting two cops. And next thing you know, I'm holding my daughter's hand. She was 18 months old, and we're walking into the Arizona State Hospital, and we're picking up my brother, and we're taking him to my mom's house because he was allowed to have supervised visits and go off site. And so I slowly let him back into my life, and over the next few years, he would call our house and talk to my daughter. And they developed, and this is where my daughter, God worked through my daughter to heal my relationship with my brother. My brother and my daughter developed a precious relationship, and he would call on the phone, and they would talk, and he adored her, and she put him on a pedestal, and she gave him joy, the only joy he ever had, and towards the end of his life. And I didn't realize at this time that God was healing my past pain through my husband and my daughter. And as I mentioned earlier, my brother ended up taking his life 4 years ago. And he was really a tortured soul, and he couldn't take it anymore. And as I mentioned, I really think he was a compulsive overeater like me. And I didn't realize it until after the fact. And I'm so grateful for the healing and compassion and love I felt towards my brother, which was only possible through God. And if it weren't for that experience, I would have had so much unfinished business with my brother. And then after I had my daughter, I was diagnosed with a medical condition, and I had to take some meds, and it made me really hungry, and I was famished, and my binging came back with a vengeance. And at this time, ironically, I ended up working in another hospital. By this time, I was, 46 or 7, something like that, and I'm 51 now. And I was a data analyst for a weight loss surgery clinic, and they did, like, gastric bypass and sleeves and all those different weight loss surgeries. And one of my jobs was to review all the complications. And because I am one of them, and I also have the twofold illness, I could see, it was very clear to me what they were doing. They were finding ways to binge again, and I could see it in the complications. And one of the girls that I worked with, So I was in and out of relapse during the time that I worked there. And then all of a sudden the physical craving would just come on really fast. And then I would end up going to the cafeteria and I would buy my binge foods. And then I would secretly eat them in my office. And then one day during this period, I ended up having a horrible binge at home. And I ate so many binge foods with extremely high amounts of sodium, and I couldn't even bend my knees, and my knees blew up like basketballs, and I could hardly bend my legs. And then the next day I went into work, and one of the girls I worked with, who was one of us, and she was getting ready to get a gastric bypass, she noticed how puffy my face was, and she commented on, she said, "Your face looks really swollen." And I lied, and I told her, you know, "Oh, I'm going to start my period." You know, and she, and I really suspected she knew that I was secretly binging. And then another time I really realized I had a problem during this period when I was in relapse is I had gotten out of, I was coming out of a relapse, and I was detoxing. And I don't know about any of you, but it takes me about 3 days to get out of detox, to go through detox. And our neighbor next door invited us over to go swimming. And after I was binging, I didn't want to see anyone. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to wear a bathing suit. So my husband and daughter went without me. And so the neighbor's wife was in the pool with my daughter, and that should have been me in the pool with my daughter. So I realized that this disease was affecting my quality time with my daughter and my husband. And you know, I wasn't present for them. And my last binge was 2 years ago on Christmas, and I had gone to my mom's for Christmas, and I was really sloppy with my food. And I remember grazing on a bowl of trail mix. And then when we got home, I ended up standing in our pantry and just binging. And my husband was in my daughter's bedroom putting together a Barbie van that she got for Christmas. I wasn't present for them at all. And I kept peering down the hall to make sure that they wouldn't come out so I could continue binging. And I had been working with a sponsor and another meeting, and they didn't study the doctor's opinion, and they just believe that you just put the fork down when you're done eating and you can have any of your binge, you know, in any of your trigger ingredients. And then I had gone through the steps with her, and then after I was done with the steps, going through the steps, we never really talked about them again. We would talk. I talked to her every day. We'd talk about the events of the day. And then I started binging again. And then she was binging again. And it was a very unhealthy situation. And I had been listening to the Vision for You meetings. And I got really scared because my binging, just I couldn't get out of it. And so I called some recovered fellows, and they told me, they said, you need to find a recovered sponsor. You need to go through the 12 steps again. And then another one told me, you know, I was like, how do I find one? And she said, you pound the pavement. And that really stuck with me. So I put my name out there, and I found someone within a week and a half, and I've been working with her for 2 years, and the only thing, studying the big book like we do, and especially the doctor's opinion, has been the only thing that has helped me. I've tried everything, and I'm just so grateful. And then on page 52, the last sentence, in the first paragraph, it says, we discard old ideas for new by the complete readiness with which we throw away the theory or gadget which does not work for something new that does. So that's what I did. And then I love the next paragraph where it says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems, this same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. And I feel like that paragraph sums up how I live and feel when I'm not recovered and I'm not working the program. For me, God either is or he is not. What is my choice to be? Like it says on page 53, the second paragraph, last two sentences, I was crushed by a self-imposed crisis and my way was not working. This disease emotionally stunted my growth, and I had to learn things for the first time in my 30s and 40s that normal people don't even think about. Like, you know, I don't know if any of you can relate to that, but I just the easy things in life I couldn't even do because I was spending so much time in bed binging, and I just, you know, like simple things like cleaning the house or you know, using a checkbook. And I tried to explain this to my husband. And because when I am binging and into food, I am a sloth. And I'm not one of those that can be productive in my life. When I binge, I just want to sleep it off, and I have no coping skills. But with this solution, now I do. By the grace of God, I no longer have anger, hatred, and resentment towards my dad or my brother like I used to. By trusting and relying in a power greater than myself and working this beautiful program, I was able to heal my past. I don't have to live like that anymore, but it is up to me not to rest on my laurels like I did for so many years. The only solution for me is to work this program one day at a time. I will never be cured of this disease. It's a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual fitness. Today, I know in my heart that my dad did the best he could. He had his own painful history just like I did. He just didn't know how to nurture me as his child. He did the best he could with what he knew. My brother didn't choose to have a severe mental illness and was mentally tortured when he was here on earth. With God's help in this beautiful program, I am able to release resentments and fears by doing the steps and working with others. And today, I do 10 steps when I have resentments and fears. For so many years, I didn't. And that has just really made a difference for me. Plus, working with others, you know, because I can never forget where I came from. I can never forget how dark it is before the dawn. And this program has helped me to see others' point of view, and then my resentments turn into love and compassion for them, just like the resentment prayer teaches us. I drive by a homeless shelter by work several times per week, and one way to honor my brother is to pray for all the mentally ill and homeless people I see as I drive by, and that's a commitment I've made to my brother. And I want to end with the second full paragraph on page 57. What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbly offered himself to his maker, then he knew. Even so has God restored us all to our right minds. To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly, but he has come to all who have honestly sought him. My experience, my personal experience, has evolved over time with my relationship with my higher power, and it was not sudden. Thank you so much for allowing me to share my experience, strength, and hope, and with that, I'll pass.
Kathleen, thank you so much for your powerful qualification this morning. Really appreciate that. So now it's going to be, you know, our opportunity to pose some questions to Kathleen, and we're going to do that. And what I'm going to ask for you is to, you know, to be able, in doing that, is to press *6 to unmute, and then what we'll do is we'll open it up to questions for her for a period of time now. So who would like to pose a question to Kathleen? Press *6 to unmute.
Good morning, Larry. This is Mary in Pasadena, California. I'd like to ask a question.
Okay, sure. And press, I'm sorry, *1. I said *6. *1, of course. Okay, let's start with Matt, and then we'll go with Amy. Matt, go ahead.
Hi, thank
you. Good morning, Kathleen.
We'll go with Matt and then Kathleen. Matt and then Amy. Matt, go ahead first, if you would.
Thank you for your service, Larry. Hi, good morning, everyone. This is Matt M., compulsive overeater from New Jersey. Thank you for your qualification, Kathleen. What do you do? Personally, I'm struggling a lot right now with the food. What do you do when you've been in the rooms for years and you have all the slogans in your head, you have all the big book knowledge, and you're just for some reason having trouble? You have the willingness, but it's just really difficult to find that last bit that you need to push through to get back in out of relapse.
Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Okay. I work the program like my life depends on it, and I tell my sponsees to be tethered to the program and live your life around the program. And in the beginning, 2 years ago, when I was coming out of relapse, I was in and out of relapse for a year, and that was just one of the relapses I was in. I could not get out of it. I just could not get out of it, and it was horrible, and I called people. I listened to meetings, the same meeting twice a day. I had to, like I said, work the program like my life depended on it and live my life around it. And as I have gone on the past 2 years, I've been able to loosen the reins a little bit. But you know what? I have a tendency to rest on my laurels and think that I can do this program on my own. And I have proven time after time after time, I cannot do that. I can't do this on my own. And like I said, this is the only thing that has worked. So I would get yourself a network of people. And if you need, did you say, are you in relapse right now?
Yes, I am.
Okay. If you need to, you know, call people before and after your meals, you know, whatever you need to do. But I would reach out to people and work this program like your life depends on it. That's what I had to do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thanks, Matt. And we have Amy. Go ahead, Amy. Press star 1 to unmute, Amy. Okay, Amy, we can't hear you, so maybe we can open it up to some others.
Jenny F.
Okay, so I have, was that Jenny?
Yes.
Okay, Jenny, and what was the last initial of your first name?
S as in Sam.
Okay, and who else would like to who else has a question?
Chrissy.
Hello, this is Mary Lee in California. I'd like to ask a question.
Okay, I got Chrissy and I got Mary Lee, and then who else?
Sharon H. in Colorado.
Okay, Sharon, gotcha. All right, let's start with that. So, and then Amy, you can come around the back end here if you're still there. So let's start with Jenny S. Jenny?
Yes, thank you. Jenny S., recovering compulsive overeater from Michigan, and thank you so much for your story. This is what I listen for on the daily meetings. Not what we should do, but what has helped someone. And you talked about the 100 forms of fear, and I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit more. How did you deal with that after you put the food down? And maybe if you could give a couple examples of how you've used step 10 with fear.
Okay. Like I mentioned, I had fear as a child, and it just stayed with me as an adult. And the last time I went through the steps with my sponsor 2 years ago, I was just plagued with fear, and I really didn't know why. And you know, but now I'm able to see, because that was my coping mechanism, and it started as a young child, and it just stayed with me as an adult. And as I mentioned, this has been the hardest piece for me, because my higher power is invisible and I can't see him. So it's very easily for me to take my will back and try to run the show myself. And then another thing about fear is what happens with me. There's someone in my life, and I just kept being very fearful of this person. And it was just one fear after another. And I couldn't figure out, why am I so fearful of this person? And I finally asked my mom, you know, why do I have this fear? And she said, because I was very fearful of my brother. And my mom said, she reminds you of your brother. And so then it triggers the fear in me. And so once I figured out where the fear was coming from, now I'm not fearful anymore. And And what I when I do have, I still do have fears though, not as many. But what I do is I have a network of recovered fellows. I call them my 10-step buddies. And what I do is I just call them, and whoever I can get a hold of, you know, I just keep calling them, and I do a fear inventory. And it's amazing because it works. And then it helps me with my fear. And it helps me realize I'm trusting and relying on myself. And that has never worked for me. And I need to trust and rely on my higher power, which is God. And the opposite of fear is faith. And that, as I mentioned, that's been a tough one for me. And it's, you know, I will never graduate from this program. We will never, Leah will never have a graduation ceremony on our meetings during the week, and we won't get caps and gowns. This is a daily reprieve, and it's up to me to work my program. Otherwise, I'll be in relapse, and I know that about me. So for me, it's critical to do 10 steps and to help others do 10 steps.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much, Jenny, for your question. Christy, you're up.
Cheryl R.
And Cheryl, we got you on the...
Hi, it's Christy.
Okay, I'm sorry, Christy. So, yeah,
that's
I called
okay.
Christy, then we'll go Mary Lee and then Sharon after that, okay?
Okay. Hi, I'm Christy. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater and anorexic from New Jersey. Thank you so much. I was touched by how you shared about your father and brother and how that was lifted, that resentment was lifted from you. And I've had that experience. And then I've also had the discouragement of having it triggered again, you know, similar to what you were just sharing about having fears triggered again. And then going through it, you know, with 10-step buddies. But getting frustrated, I think that I'm getting frustrated sometimes with, I guess, having it triggered again. It's like, I just want it to be gone. And I just wanted to know how you cope with that in your faith, you know, having your higher power remove it to a degree, but not removing it completely, and how you don't get a resentment against God or the program in that. That's my question.
And I'm sorry, what was the last part of your question?
Did you ask me for a follow-up something?
Yeah, what was the last part of your question?
Well, how do you not, you know, with the, I know, you know, you'll rework it through a 10-step, but how do you not lose heart? You know, how do you just keep plugging away when the same things keep cropping up? And how do you not fall into a depression over the fact that it does come back and the higher power doesn't lift it all at once on your terms?
Well, you know, one resentment that keeps coming up for me is the clutter in my house. And, you know, it's just something that I have to continue working on. And one thing about me, I get triggered when there's clutter in my house, because when I was face down in the food and was sleeping all the time and the blinds were drawn and I didn't see sunlight, and unless I went out to the store to get my binge food, I didn't do anything. As I mentioned, I was a sloth, and I didn't do anything. I didn't shower. I didn't, I just didn't do anything. And so when there is, you know, I have a husband and a daughter, and you know, plus me, it's hard for me to like pick up. I've always had issues with that. And it's just a residual of my eating disorder. So it's just something that I have to constantly work on, you know. And what step are you on?
I'm working 10, 11, and 12.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, just continue doing 10 steps. And another thing, you know, the big book, in the acceptance part, I think it's on page 417, I have to read that a lot, just okay. accepting, you know, because I have tendencies to be controlling, and that when I am controlling, I'm not trusting on my higher power. I'm taking my will back. So
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the question. Mary Lee, your turn.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you, Larry, for being of service. My question just got totally answered with the last answer. I, too, had a mentally ill brother and a father, the same as you, and you've just so many similarities. Maybe it would be helpful if you could enlarge exactly how you do your 10th step around that fear. Could you just kind of give me an example, please? Thank you.
Sure. Basically, what I do, I have a form right here. I just print out the fear inventory. You know, there's several different forms that we can get online, and I just print it out. I keep those with me in my book bag at work, because I never know when I'm going to have a resentment or a fear. And I also have some step prayers, and so I have it with me, and I just do everything that's on the form, just like I did with my my step four. So that's how I do it. I just do, and then I also can read page 60. I believe it's page 67 in the big book on fear. You know, and I have to continually. That's on page 68, I believe. I have to continually, 67 and 68, I have to continually read that section, you know, because I will take, you know, I will rely on finite self. And it's like, when will I learn that that doesn't work? And one thing about, and, you know, and then when I was coming out of relapse, I would read the first 164 pages. I just kept reading, even though we were reading it on the line. I saturated myself with the program. And, you know, and the answers are in this book, the solution. And so to answer your question, I just use the form. I use an inventory form for my fears.
Thank you so much for the question, Mary Lee. And Sharon from Colorado. You're up, Sharon.
Cheryl R.
Thank you, Larry. Can you hear me?
I can, and I
I
heard you, Cheryl. I got you, Cheryl. Go ahead, Sharon.
Okay. Oh, thank you, Kathleen. Thank you for your story. It just touched my heart, and I could relate so much to the fear, because that was my issue from the time I was a little child, too. And but a couple questions I had to ask you is, one, you know, the alcohol foods, by God's grace, those have been laid down, and I treat them just like, you know, I would not take a drink of alcohol. I was just wondering if you could share a little bit more of what your parameters are around food behaviors on a daily basis. And the other thing is the step 10, and what about step 11? I just recently had someone share with me how she does step 11, and I thought, wow, I've never really gotten into that to that degree. So if you could just share about those two things, Kathleen, thank you.
Okay. As far as food behaviors, I don't eat in my car. I used to binge in my car while I was driving. If I'm in a situation where I have to bring, you know, I know we don't really want to focus on food, but if I'm going to be out all day, I bring my food with me, and I may have to eat in my car while it's parked.
Okay.
But I don't drive and binge, and I don't stand up while I'm eating. And let me see. And you, let me see. I had.
She was asking about step 11 as well.
Yeah, let me see. I had that marked in the book. Let me see. Can anyone remind me what page the steps are on the big book? I had it marked, and now I can't find my bookmark.
I believe 59.
59, okay, thank you. Oh, you know what? My bookmark was in the way. okay, so step 11, spiritual awareness, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. What I do is during my lunch, I go to a quiet place. I clock out because I work, and I go to a quiet place. I put earplugs in. I eat my lunch, and I have some things that I read, my devotionals that help me. And I read, and it keeps me close to my higher power. And it's really helped me with my fears, too. And that's what I do. And then, you know, that way, if I have a fear, I can, you know, when I read and I feel closer to my higher power, and then I feel peace in my heart, and it just helps me get through the day. And then sometimes while I'm brushing my teeth, I may read some devotionals too. So I try to utilize whatever time I have with my busy schedule.
Thank you so much for the question, Sharon. And Cheryl, you're up.
Thanks, Larry. And Kathleen, thank you for that terrific share. I'm Cheryl R. from Virginia. I just wanted to ask a question. Since so often our triggers, you know, are these relationships with other people and reacting off of you know, our daily interactions with some people that cause our triggers, how do you deal with expectations of others on a daily basis? Thank you.
Expectations, I've been told, are resentments under construction. Sometimes I have to read the acceptance part of the big book. You know, I get, when I expect people to follow my script, I am going to be disappointed in their behavior, and then I'm going to have to do a resentment inventory, 10-step. So I just, you know, it's all about accepting people for who they are, and you know, and then, you know, one thing that I mentioned, you know, with my dad, one thing that's really helped me turn my resentment into compassion and love and tolerance for people is trying to see their point of view through God's lenses. And, you know, in everyone, you know, a lot of people in my life don't have a 12-step program, and they have past hurts and pain, and, you know, they're trying to live life on their own self-will. And if I can kind of, you know, see where they're coming from, that helps me. And I learned that from working the program. And that helps me to have compassion towards people. I have more compassion towards people now, whereas I didn't. I was very critical and judgmental. That's one of my character defects.
Thank you for the question, Cheryl. I love that. Resentment under construction. I didn't expect for it to be raining while I'm in my car here, Kathleen, because after all, you guys might hear it, and then you might think I'm human, and oh gosh, I don't want that. Anyway, who else would like to, or has a question for Kathleen? Press star one to unmute.
Hi, this is Kathy Kay.
Okay, Kathy.
Hi, this is Jen and R. Hi, this is Jen R. from Maryland.
Okay, we got Kathy, we got Jen R. Anybody else want to jump in this pool? It's really warm.
Yes, this is Kathleen S. in upstate New York.
Kathy. Kathleen's jumping in. Anybody else?
Anita D.
Anita's going to jump in. Who else? Okay, let's go with that for now. We got Kathy K, we got Jen R, we got Kathleen, and we got Anita. Kathy K, you're up.
Thank you, Larry, for your service. And Kathleen, thanks so much for your story today. It was really wonderful to listen and to learn. I'm somebody who's very dedicated to doing service, and I regularly follow up with newcomers and obviously have a few people I'm sponsoring. And I wonder if you could reflect anything that made it possible for you to really get recovery with the last sponsor that you worked with starting 2 years ago. I mean, did she do something different that helped you really engage the step work in a way you never did before, or was it just a matter of you being willing? Any reflections you have on that would be helpful.
Okay. Well, I spent years in the rooms, and I never studied the big book, and I never understood, even though I had experience with binge drinking, I never understood how it related to my eating disorder, and I certainly never studied the doctor's opinion, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And so the difference for me was, you know, because ever since I had my daughter, I do phone meetings, and I've been in all sorts of different phone meetings, and I would rest on my laurels, and I would just listen to the meetings, and that's all I did. I wouldn't do 10 steps. I wouldn't sponsor anyone. I was taking. I was not giving. And so the difference for me was studying the big book like my life depended on it, and and studying the doctor's opinion. Now I get it. Now I know what's wrong with me, and I cannot ingest my trigger foods. If I do, I will binge, and that is what made the difference for me. If I rest on my laurels and I stop working the program, I'm setting myself up for a relapse. So, and I will, as I mentioned, I will never be cured. Just like they say, once a pickle, you can't go back to being a cucumber. So, and why I have this, I don't know. It doesn't matter. You know, I just do. So, you know, what the only thing I can do is work the program. And like I said, it's the only thing that's worked for me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. Jen. Jen R., just press star 1 to unmute.
Hi there. This is Jen R. in Maryland, and I am living your story right now with my dad and a stepbrother, and I understand that I need to recover completely and do the acceptance prayer and stuff to not expect my dad to accept me and include me. But until that point, I'm still going to the hardware store looking for milk, as they say in the program. I'm still going to my dad looking for love, and I'm not getting it. Should I just stay away until I recover and can accept that I'm not going to get it? Or do I just keep putting myself in that situation to be hurt? And that's all.
What step are you on?
I'm on step 1.
Step 1?
Newly abstinent on step 1.
Okay. I would just keep working the program, and like your life depends on it. Are you working with a sponsor?
Yes, I am a recovered sponsor, very hard on it, yeah.
Okay. And, I would just keep going. I would go through all the steps, and eventually, you know, you'll get through that. But the only thing that's going to help is to just make sure that you go through all the steps.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Jen. And then we have Kathleen the Dream. Kathleen S., you're up. Kathleen, press star one.
Hi there. Hi, Kathleen. I'm Kathleen from a recovering compulsive overeater from upstate New York. And I'm also clean and sober many years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a very dear friend. In fact, she's like my best friend. And she's sober more than 30 years like me, too. We both got sober like 20. And I love her dearly. And she is going to a program called Food Addicts Anonymous, which is very different than Overeaters Anonymous, and I respect her recovery. And we were out shopping, and there was a little somebody. It was right before Christmas, and they had like a little coffee kiosk, and they were giving away these little samples. Now, I mean, I can drink coffee; it's not a problem. And she said it was chocolate chai. Now, my thoughts was, you know, it's just this flavored coffee. It has nothing in it. Well, I took this little drink very innocently, and I took a swig, and I almost spit out into the girl because it had so much sugar in it, and almost gagged me. And I was like, oh, my God, there's so much sugar. And I was like, oh! And I just, you know, threw it away. And my friend took a real offense to that. And I said, Sharon, this was done real innocently. I did not, I just thought it was flavored coffee, a little sample of flavored coffee. Oops, I made a mistake. And she was just so almost Gestapo-like about it. And I know that for me, that I cannot stay sober going to OA, and I cannot stay abstinent. Going to AA, that they're two different diseases for me, and I have to work both programs. I have an awesome
Kathleen, do you have a Kathleen? I'm sorry. Do you have a question, my dear? Yes.
Okay, my question is I have this judgmentalness over my friend, and I just don't know how to handle it. I just feel so judged by her.
You have a resentment towards her? Is that what you said?
No, not resentment. I'm judged by her. I don't resent her. I love her dearly. I don't know how to handle her judgment towards me. Because we're going.
And what step are you on?
I am on one. I'm abstinent in about 52 days. 50.
Are you working with a recovered sponsor?
I am. She's awesome.
Okay. it's probably, that may be a resentment that's going to go on your four step. I would jot that down and, you know, since you're only on step one, what I tell my sponsees, anytime something crops up, as they're working on this, as I'm taking them through the steps, to jot things like that down because they're going to go on your resentment sheet. To me, that sounds like a resentment.
Uh-huh.
So, and you can talk to your sponsor about that, when, you know, once you get through when you're doing your step four.
Thanks for the question, Kathleen.
Okay.
Appreciate that. You bet. And I don't know if I believe it was Alita, I'm informed, rather than Anita, but I could be wrong about that. Maybe Alita's in there too. Tomato, tomato. Is it Alita?
Yes, this is Alita D.
Oh, Alita. Thank you. You're up.
Recover compulsive overeater for today. Kathleen, thank you so much for your hope and recovery story. I love you kept saying I work my program like my life depends on it, but I know that being mother of a teenager or a 11-year-old and working and husband and life can be very, very complex, you know. So how do you do the balance, you know, because it takes a long time if I'm going to do the, if I'm going to study the big book and I'm going to do the meetings and, you know, it takes a few hours a day just to go to meetings and then working with the sponsors and working with the sponsees and how do you balance life with the program? And I guess that's my question. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you know, I spent a lot of time binging and going to the grocery store and buying my binge foods and sleeping. So I can spend a lot of time. I can figure out ways in my day. I have a very busy schedule, and I'm mandated to work this program. I don't have a choice unless I want to relapse. And I certainly found a lot of time to relapse. And so I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm a morning. I used to hate mornings when I was had a food hangover. Now I love mornings. That's my quiet time. And I am doing from 4 a.m. to 8 o'clock when I go to work. I'm already working my program for 4 hours. I'm on the meeting. You know, I'm talking to people. I'm responding to emails. So by the time I get to work, I already have worked my program for 4 hours. And it's kind of funny. I've always felt like I live this dual life. The people I work with, they have no idea what I do behind the scenes. You know, it's like a separate part of me that they don't know about. And I just, you know, I make outreach calls during my break. I text people while I'm working. Whatever I can do to stay connected to program. I have a headset. I can talk to people in my car. You know, if your recovery is important to you, you will find ways to work it. I have my daughter will be 10. She knows when I'm in the closet, the master closet, I am to not be disturbed and I'm talking to someone. She doesn't really understand what it's all about yet, but she knows that I'm talking on the phone. Sometimes she comes in, but it's imperative to me to work my program and to find time to work it.
Thank you for your question, Alita. So we have time for a few more questions for Kathleen, if you'd like to jump in. Press star 1 to unmute if you'd like to ask Kathleen a question.
This is Brenna. I have a question.
Was it Jenna?
Drenna, with a B.
Drenna. Okay, Drenna. And anybody else?
Carol G.
Hi, Carol. You're going to be after Drenna. Hello, good morning. And who after Carol? Okay, let's go with Drenna. I'm sorry, there's one other person that maybe wanted to jump in. Who is that?
Hi, Larry. This is Deanne F. from Long Island.
Okay, Deanne. And so was it Brenna?
Yes. Yeah, Brenna.
Oh, my God. I have to clean my ears out today. Brenna, you go. You're right.
No problem. Thank you so much for sharing. I have two questions, but one is about sponsorship, and it's a twofold question with sponsorship. Do you have any guidance on how to approach sponsorship for someone who has a relapse? Do you continue sponsoring? Do you wait? You know, do you have any feedback on that? And then my second question is, if one is working with a sponsor who does not themselves have a sponsor but works directly from the big book, do you have any thoughts or opinions on that?
I'm sorry, what was your second question?
Sponsoring without a sponsor. So sponsoring from someone, I've had in my past a sponsor who did not herself work with a sponsor, but she worked directly from the big book and said she was very clear that the big book enables that. And I just was wondering if you have any opinions on that or feedback or experience or suggestions for sponsoring in this.
You mean working with someone who doesn't call themselves a sponsor?
No, calls herself a sponsor, but does not have a sponsor herself.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you know, the big book doesn't talk about the word sponsor until we get into the stories. Then it brings up the word sponsor. But it doesn't, in the first 164 pages, it doesn't say, quote-unquote, sponsor. That's why, you know, a lot of people call themselves big book guides. As long as she is taking, you know, if she can take people through the steps and not be a, call herself a, quote-unquote, sponsor. I hope I'm answering that correctly. And then to answer the other, the first question you had, on page 96, it gives us instructions. Sometimes people are not ready to put down the food, and it is not our job to chase them, because there is hundreds of people next in line. And it's not mean, but if someone is not ready, they're not ready. And on page 96, it says, do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. And then you can go on and read the whole paragraph. And if someone is not ready, you just move on to someone who is. And, you know, and I've worked with people who they just couldn't get out of relapse, and they wanted me to continue working with them. And I was willing to, you know, a couple times, but then finally, you know, because of the directions in, on page 96, I just told them, you know, I don't think you're ready, and I am here for you. Anytime you want to call me, just call me. And so the big book is very clear in the instructions.
Thank you. I have one other question. Okay.
Sure.
Thank you. Do you, someone had asked about your food a little bit earlier, but I'm just curious, do you have a meal plan that you follow, or how do you kind of dictate that?
Well, that's kind of an outside issue.
Okay.
And it is recommended that we see a nutritionist. I've seen, I just recently saw a nutritionist. So, you know, My bodily needs are different from yours. You know, my body's different from yours. My body's different from Larry's. And so we all have, it's highly recommended that that we see a nutritionist.
Got it. And does your nutritionist give you a specific meal plan to follow? I guess that's what I was asking.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Brenna. Thanks for your question. Carol, you're up, Carol.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's Carol G., Recovered Compulsive Overeater. Good morning, Kathy.
Hi.
Good morning, and thank you so much. You've got a lovely energy about you. I've really enjoyed your share. My question is about your relationship with your higher power in your life. In what ways is God everything for you, and what can get in the way sometimes of God being everything for you?
When I take my will back, that is me getting in the way. I had, and just recently, well, it's been last summer, it was around that time where that person that was in my life, I kept having fear, one after another. And I kept taking my will back, and I wasn't trusting and relying on my higher power. And I kept having it's like I can go for a few weeks without fear. And then this particular week, last summer, I was plagued with fear. And it was a reoccurring fear with this person in my life. And then there was a huge thing that happened. I was house-sitting for our neighbor. And my daughter and I went over there to water their plants, and I was distracted. My daughter she irritated me. I had a resentment, and I got distracted. And so I left their garage door open for 12 hours. And we live in a neighborhood where there's been theft. And I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was plagued with fear. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I think I left the neighbor's garage door open all night for 12 hours. And here in Arizona, it is light at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I wake up at 4. So I went out there. Sure enough, their garage door was open for 12 hours. I was plagued with fear. I don't know about you, but it was fight or flight. I had the adrenaline going. I went over to the neighbor's house. I wasn't even thinking straight. I walked in their house. I checked every nook and cranny. Someone could have been in there. They could have, you know, attacked me. My husband was upset that I did that, but I wasn't thinking clearly. And then to me, the message was, and by the grace of God, nothing was stolen. Everything was in its place, and I had fear about telling the neighbor. And I ended up having to do a 10-step that morning. And I think I called someone and woke her up. And so my message from my higher power was, you know what? You're not trusting, relying on me. You keep having these fears. You keep taking your will back. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow this huge thing to happen. I'm going to protect the house. And now, do you trust and rely on me? And so that was the message that I got from my higher power. So does that answer your question? I hope I didn't get off on a bunny trail.
No, I think that was great. Thank you so much for your question, Carol. And Diane, jump right in.
Hi, Larry.
Good morning.
This is Deanne F. From Long Island, a grateful recovered compulsive overeater today. For 1 year, this is my 1 year abstinent date today, and I'm so excited to hear a really wonderfully recovered speaker. Kathleen, thank you so much for your share. My question is with your 10th step. You know, my sponsor always says that if you don't do them right away, that it is like having poo on your shoe, that you are just trekking all over every place and everyone and everything. And so she always encourages me to, you know, to give them away. But I have to say that I actually have a lot of fear around that. Like, I don't, you know, I want to know how actually you do it. Do you literally just stop everything you're doing and call someone? Do you write it down? Can you just talk a little bit about those all day long 10 steps? Thank you so much.
what I do, if I'm at work and I have a 10-step, you know, fear or resentment that crops up, as I mentioned, I keep a fear sheet and a resentment sheet in my book bag, and I also have a bunch of step prayers. I keep that all stapled together because I never know when I'm going to have a resentment or a fear, and I will, during my lunch or even at my desk sometimes, I will write it out. And then I will text someone or call someone and ask if they will take my 10th step. And I will go into a conference room. I'll do a 10th step, or I'll do it when I'm leaving work. And yesterday I had a resentment, and I was at the store, and I was buying a gift card for my stepfather, and I was obsessing about something my mom said, and that's what I've learned of resentment is, if it takes up space in my head rent free, and I'm obsessing about it, and it just will not go away, I need to do a 10 step because I will obsess. And so I just kept calling people. Recovered people. I left messages, and I couldn't get a hold of anyone. I left a message on one of my 10-step buddies' voicemail, and then someone called me back, and so I was able to talk to her and do the 10-step. So that's what I do. And to me, I can't rest on my laurels and not do a 10-step because I did that before, and it just kept me in relapse for most of my adult life. So I can't, you know, it talks about how, you know, resentment should be the same as feeling. And it's a poison. We cannot, that's why we eat. And, you know, that's why we binge, because I used to anesthetize myself with the food because I could not deal with those feelings. And I just numbed myself out by binging, my brains out. And then I didn't have to feel anything. But then I would end up having a food hangover, and it was horrible. So I have to do 10 steps. I have to find time. So that's what I do.
Thanks so much, Deanne, for your question. Well, the lights go on. Last call from the Bakery of Wisdom here. Who wants to jump in? Anybody?
Leah S.
Leah, why don't you finish it up for us here with the question. Go ahead, Leah.
Hi. Thank you so very much. My question is, in doing a 10-step, I still cannot let go of projection, and let me briefly tell you, there's an event coming up, a very emotional event, and it's inevitable, and I just cannot let go of projection. And I need some more depth into it because I've worked on it. Obviously, if it is bothering me to the extent that I keep on doing the same 10-step, and maybe you can give me some more insight on how to let it go finally. Thank you.
Is it fear? Is there fear involved?
No, it's not fear. It's pain.
Okay.
It's pain.
Like physical pain?
It's, no, emotional pain.
Okay. Well, you know, you may, well, it could, you could have some underlying fear, if you're projecting, something that's going to happen in the future. It sounds like, to me, like it might be a fear. And, you know, I've heard other fellows say that sometimes they just have to keep working the same 10-step over something. And I, you know, as I mentioned, one thing that always crops up for me is just the clutter. You know, it's not going to go away. And it's about, as I mentioned, you know, reading the acceptance section in the big book on page 417, you know, accepting that, you know, things are the way they are, and I can't control anything. And I've learned that all of my fear is fancied and not real, just like the big book says. And I can see that when I look in the rearview mirror. And once I've come through something and I'm out the other side, I can see where my thinking got me into trouble, and it never turns out the way that I projected it to turn out, and it always ends up being okay. But for, you know, I have a built-in forgetter, and I always take my will back. And, you know, it gets better as time goes by, but I'll never graduate. I'll never be cured. I hope that helps.
That helped so much. The words clutter helped me tremendously. I have to work on my yoga. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Kathleen, thank you so much. We just our sincerest gratitude for your qualification this morning and your words of wisdom. Just to, you know, as we're wrapping up here, I'd like to let you know a couple of things. One is that the share ID for Kathleen's special edition this morning is 8299. That's 8299. And you can hear that on the recorded line once this meeting is over, 8299. Also, Kathleen's contact information will be provided, unless Kathleen tells me, no, you lughead, it won't be. But I think it will be at the end of the meeting. So, but let's, okay, terrific. Thank you, Kathleen. And with that, let's wrap up the meeting the way we typically do. And I'll read a vision for you. At the very end of the chapter here, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.